Welcome back to the audio version of the self-esteem book. We now bring you part 4.
Chapter 9, Why We Keep Our Moods in Place. You may say that you hate living in continual turmoil and are tired of being at odds with others and feeling badly about yourself. You may think this should be incentive enough to reinvent yourself in your interpretations. If the process of recognizing your mood, releasing your emotion, reinterpreting what happened, recreating your future, and reclaiming your self-esteem is so simple, then why do we keep these old patterns in place? The answer lies in the addictive nature of our moods. We hate being angry, sad, or afraid. However, like a heroin addict who hates being hooked on drugs but can't seem to pull that needle from his arm, so it is with our moods. Our moods keep us churning in the drama cycle of life. Though we dislike them, they're familiar and they're comfortable like an old habit. They also make us feel alive. Our moods provide us with several contrary pleasures and ironic benefits. They make us right and they make others wrong. They allow us to feel like we're dominating others, or they help us to avoid being dominated ourselves. They make us a victim of our circumstances. As a victim, we get to feel sorry for ourselves. Victims attract pity and sympathy of others. It's often easier to wallow in pity rather than take responsibility for making our lives work optimally. As we continue to suffer, our self-esteem dwindles further. Our lives seem full of things that we don't want. We want all the things that we don't have. We point to our low self-esteem in an effort to justify why life is the way that it is. It's no wonder that we continue to suffer and feel bad about who we are. The more that we hate having low self-esteem, the more that we use it to justify why we can't reinvent our lives to be fulfilling and productive. Having low self-esteem gets us off the hook for turning our lives around. Keeping our addictive moods and our low self-opinion in place also has other ironic benefits. By reinforcing the feeling that no matter how hard we try, we still fail to measure up, we keep the game in place. We tell ourselves that we will do better. That might mean trying harder, studying more, or spending more time with the person we just can't seem to satisfy. Our life becomes dedicated to climbing over the next hill ahead that challenges us. We tell ourselves that if we can just crest that one hill, we will be worthy of praise and acceptance. So we do whatever it takes to make it up that next hill. However, upon reaching the top, we find yet another, more important hill before us. We beat ourselves up for not having climbed high enough in the first place, but recommit to taking on this new challenge under the assumption that arriving at the top of this next peak will make us good enough. Of course, the hills continue to appear, offering a constant series of new challenges to conquer. In an ironic way, the never good enough setup that drives us does produce some transient victories. These short-lived accomplishments allow us to take fleeting pride in what we've achieved. They also may be worthwhile feats, but we're too blind to accept that, too driven by the belief that who we are can never be good enough. So this structure permits us to retain hope in our ability to somehow overcome our unworthiness. By achieving perfection and becoming whatever it is that we fear that we are not. It also protects us from lack by being forever driven to produce. However, before long, we revert back to the feeling that our latest achievement is hardly enough. We find ourselves back on the treadmill, racing up the next hill, feeling bad about ourselves once again. But continuing to take pleasure in self-pity without taking responsibility for reclaiming our self-esteem has profound costs. Identifying these costs can be the first step in generating the motivation to have this unwanted condition disappear. Here's an exercise. What are some of the major reasons for keeping your moods in place? What contrary benefit do you get from these addictive moods? Chapter 10, The Cost of Not Reclaiming Our Self-Esteem. Mike Smith, president of the Freedom Foundation, also tells us that suffering is having something that you don't want or wanting something that you don't have. Responsibility is the key to eliminating suffering and elevating self-esteem. There are many costs associated with our reluctance to claim responsibility for empowering interpretations that source our esteem and our excellence. One is in the area of our relationships. We can develop richly rewarding relationships with others only if we hold ourselves as worthy of such contribution. Our moods and our misinterpretations destroy the likelihood of workable relationships. They distance us from others, and they isolate us. We mistakenly assume that others see the same devastating faults in us that we see in ourselves. We expect them to reject us as unworthy of their friendship, not good enough to get their love or their attention. We become easily angered, sad, or afraid. We avoid new challenges that might expose our faults. We isolate ourselves and we shun social situations in an effort to protect ourselves from hurt. Our actions anticipate rejection, and they actually bring it about as a self-fulfilling prophecy. We dismiss any of our own perspectives as wrong, sacrificing them for someone else's, who must be more worthy than we are. We consistently shut down our own interests and our viewpoints as being automatically flawed or worthless. When people appear to be interested in our friendship, we fail to set healthy limits, or we avoid responsibility by making reasonable requests for fear of being rejected. Or taking another approach, we expose their flaws and reject them as unworthy of our friendship. After all, who would want to be friends with someone who would want us as their friend? We then cite these damaged relationships as evidence that there's something terribly wrong with us, and so our self-esteem dwindles. We pay another cost of low self-esteem with deteriorating physical and mental health. All physical and mental disease is the manifestation of an emotional condition. Sooner or later, low self-esteem and the resulting lack of emotional health will translate into a breakdown of the body. This is most obvious with heart disease and with cancer. Withholding love for ourselves ages us prematurely. Our cells age and die, and our bodies respond negatively from the deprivation of joy and happiness. We put on excess weight, develop ulcers, and suffer sickness and disease. Or in an effort to numb our pain, we attempt to escape into the oblivion of drugs, alcohol, isolation, or other addictions. When you don't love yourself, you don't treat yourself with respect. You live along the automatic assumption that you're not worth taking care of. So you neglect eating right, exercising, getting medical attention, or looking after your well-being. Disease results from what's going on at a cellular level, fueled by a deprivation of love. Loss of happiness, self-expression, and vitality also stems from low self-esteem. Those lacking self-belief give up their ability to make a difference in others' lives. These costs spread to family members and afflict those closest to those lacking self-esteem. With the loss of happiness and self-expression comes loss of love, intimacy, partnership, and affinity. It is difficult to love someone who does not love himself. Intimacy is a function of clean and open communication. Such communication is often the first casualty when self-esteem suffers. Perhaps the greatest cost of not taking total responsibility for managing our interpretations is the lost possibilities for our lives to be lived richly and with purpose. When our self-esteem suffers, we lose our potential for identifying and fulfilling our life's purpose. To take our focus off of our needs, faults, challenges, and concerns, we must first believe in our ability to contribute to others. Contributing ourselves, not sacrificing, but freely giving renewable value, stems from both the commitment to serve and the knowledge that we have something worthwhile to offer. When we hold ourselves in low esteem, we shortchange others as well as devaluing ourselves. We lose sight of our magnificence and forget that we all have special qualities, talents, and gifts that would benefit others. Not taking responsibility for our greatness cheats the world as we sell out our potential to impact others with the special gifts that only we can offer. One way to handle this preoccupation with our fears is to focus on worthwhile achievements that are much more significant than our petty concerns. By committing to some worthwhile and lofty undertaking, we can get unstuck, we can take the focus off of our own concerns and our problems, and build our self-image in the process. You can alter your self-destructive attitudes by pursuing the personal development principles presented in this book. But the vast majority suffering from low self-esteem are blind to this conscious option. Awareness must come first. Rather than take on the challenge of reinterpreting life's events, most adopt various ways of protecting themselves from what they perceive to be a dangerous world. They resign themselves to do the best that they can, knowing that it will never be good enough. Here's an exercise. What are the costs of not reclaiming your self-esteem? Consider the areas of your health, relationships, vitality, happiness, and ability to contribute to others. What prices have you already paid? Chapter 11, Survival Formulas. Some refuse to develop their self-esteem even after becoming aware of their ability to successfully do so. Having low self-esteem makes a person a victim. Victims feel sorry for themselves instead of accepting responsibility for their excellence and for making life work. Faced with the idea that they are somehow less worthy or completely worthless, those lacking self-esteem protect themselves in the best way that they know how. They see this being necessary in a world where they don't fully belong and are less likely to thrive. In the interest of self-preservation, the human machinery adapts to outside situations in a myriad of ways. The goal is always survival. Some adapt by hiding out. Others take the offensive. Some become clever and outsmart the competition. Many become passive and look for others to take pity on them. Everyone has their own unique survival formula adopted at an early age to protect them from the apparent threat that others represent. Since this protective behavior seemed to work at some time to keep them safe, they repeated or amended it as they grew into adulthood. Some decided that physical strength was the best means of protection, so they developed their muscles and they learned the skills that warriors possess in an effort to become stronger than their enemies. Others saw force as a means of exerting power. These people became the world's bullies, dictators, and tyrants. Or maybe they decided to dominate in a legal, acceptable manner by becoming policemen, soldiers, or others in uniform. Possibly, they sought a title to gain the prestige that they would need to control others or to avoid being dominated. Still others decided that the secret to survival was money and possessions. They developed a strategy to be richer and thus safer and better able to manipulate others. Others saw that they could control best by honing their abilities. They became educated, maybe they learned special skills, or they sought to outsmart or outperform their adversaries. In the end, survival strategies are all about gaining power to erase their feelings of being small and powerless. They share the assumption that what power we have inside us as a person is not sufficient to survive or thrive in the world. We need to find a better way to compete and to win out over others. The next several case studies will elucidate how people respond to the dangers of living and how they endeavor to keep safe from all the perils. All survival formulas are based on doing, not being. Because they view themselves as being dramatically flawed, they feel compelled to do something externally to deal with their defective nature. As such, the survival formulas are flawed and do not address the source of low self-esteem. Happiness and a sense of self-worth must reside within us. They are not places to get to, but a place from which to come. When we live with the confidence of knowing who we are and what our gifts are, we manifest our life purpose. Our actions will then be productive and characterized by high self-esteem. Case studies. Not trusting is usually about us, not the person that we mistrust. Learn to trust others by trusting yourself first. With elevated self-esteem comes increased trust. All human beings lie at times. Courageously decide to trust and to recognize that everyone makes mistakes. Case study number one, the facts. Laura went to an eye doctor when she was 7 years old. The eye doctor asked Laura's mom to wait in the reception room while he examined Laura. The doctor sexually molested Laura and made her promise not to tell anyone or else he'd hurt her family. Laura's interpretation about herself was that she was bad to have tempted the doctor, who complimented her on her pretty dress. She was thus a bad and dirty girl. Laura's interpretation about people was that people always hurt her and can't be trusted. Laura's mood is rage leading to fear. Laura's survival formula is to hide and to cheat in order to survive. Laura accepted the blame for what happened in the doctor's office that day. She decided that she was bad and that it was her fault that the doctor did what he did. Based upon this interpretation, Laura decided that people can't be trusted and she couldn't trust herself. Laura decided that in order to survive in a world where others lie, hurt, and threaten little girls, she would have to be more clever than they were and get what she could before they hurt her. Laura lied and cheated at every opportunity, becoming a habitual liar and a con artist. She maintained a low profile in her personal life, avoided social occasions, and had few friends. Her self-esteem suffered, and she assumed that she didn't belong. She also told herself that men couldn't be trusted and were interested only in sex. She married and divorced 3 times. Each time she trusted men less and considered herself to be a loser who no one really wanted to be with. Case study number 2. Here are the facts. When John was 3 years old, his mom and dad brought home a new baby brother from the hospital. They told him that they loved him just as much, but they paid a lot of attention to the new baby. John's interpretation about himself was that he was not good enough because his parents needed another baby to replace him. John's interpretation about other people was that people lie and steal from you, just like his parents lied about loving him and his baby brother stole their love. John's mood is indignant anger. In other words, how dare you? John's survival formula is to be a people pleaser and to do whatever it takes to have people like him. When John was 3 years old, he decided that he was not enough for his parents. This explained why his parents would bring home a little intruder, his brother Jim. John decided that if he was to be allowed to stay around, he had better get his parents and later others to like him. His survival depended upon it. John became the teacher's pet in school and the dutiful son at home. He settled for jobs that paid poorly and never asked for a raise or time off. He was just happy to have any job at all. John went through life settling for less, with his motto being, don't rock the boat. Case study number 3. Here are the facts. Linda's dad drank almost every day upon coming home from work. About once a week, he would get drunk and become violent, throwing and smashing things and hitting Linda and her brother Michael. When she was 9 years old, Linda's dad pushed her out of the way. She fell down the stairs and broke her arm. Linda's interpretation about herself was that she was bad and unlovable. Her dad didn't love her. Linda's interpretation about people was that people don't care and are selfish. Linda's survival formula was don't let anything bother you. Don't feel emotions. Care even less than others do. Linda felt rage at her father for hurting her. She felt guilty for hating him when she knew she should love him. Linda decided at 9 years old that it was too painful to love anyone. All people did was hurt you, so it's safer not to care. She suppressed her emotions and refused to allow others to get close to her. She usually avoided dating, and when she did, she would not allow any relationship to get serious. Her lack of close friends and intimate relationships proved to her that she was not worth loving. Case study number 4. Here are the facts. Bill's dad died in a car accident when he was 5 years old, leaving him behind along with his mom and his older sister. His mom said to Bill, "Bill, you're now the man of the family." Bill's interpretation about himself was that he was weak, but he must be strong and protect his mom and his sister. Bill's interpretation about other people is that people abandon you. Bill's survival formula was to be strong and tough. When his dad died at age 5, Bill became a man. He decided that the world was a dangerous place and anyone might die or be hurt at any time, especially those he loved. Bill decided he would act tough, even though he felt weak and vulnerable. Although he was intelligent, Bill neglected his studies to work 2 jobs in between workout sessions at the gym. Bill became a police officer and enjoyed carrying his gun everywhere he went. Bill told himself that he was probably too dumb to have succeeded in school anyway. Case study number 5. Here are the facts. At age 6, Paul went to his neighbor's house to play. His neighbor's older cousins beat him up and called him names. Paul ran home crying. His neighbor's grandmother said, "Paul's being just a baby." Paul's interpretation about himself is that he was stupid, weak, and a wimp. Paul's interpretation about people are that they're mean and cruel and that they're out to get you. Paul's survival formula turned out to be smarter than everyone else. Paul blamed himself for being stupid enough to visit his neighbor while his older cousins were there. He decided that he went looking for trouble. When Paul took a beating at the hands of his neighbor's older cousins, he determined that the world was a dangerous place and that if he was to survive, it wouldn't be by defending himself physically. When the adult on the scene, his neighbor's grandmother, refused to defend him, he decided that no one else could protect him, so he better find a way to protect himself. He would have to outsmart his opponents. While his friends were playing outside, Paul spent his free time studying. He couldn't get enough knowledge. Paul became a perpetual student, continuing to take classes even after getting his PhD. Case study number 6. The facts are that Mary wanted a Chatty Cathy doll for Christmas. She got a sweater and pants instead. Her mom said that she had enough dolls and that they couldn't afford wasting money. Mary's interpretation about herself was that she wasn't worth spending money on. Mary's interpretation about people was that people don't listen to your needs and that they don't care. Mary's interpretation about the world was that there's scarcity of resources and not enough to go around. Mary's survival formula was to save money and to don't care. Mary must have had a dozen dolls, but she really wanted this special one. When her mom gave her clothes instead, she felt that if she were good enough, and that if her mom really loved her, she would have bought her the doll that she wanted. Mary reasoned that her mom knew very well how much she wanted that doll, but she didn't listen, and she didn't care, so she must not have been worth spending the money on. She decided that since there weren't enough to go around, only those who were worth it would be taken care of. Mary decided to work overtime and not spend her money frivolously. She would sacrifice and save for a rainy day when she might need it. Every time she considered treating herself to something nice, like a fancy restaurant dinner, she would reconsider. After all, she didn't want to waste money by spending it on herself. Besides, she didn't care anyways. Case study number 7. Here are the facts. At age 18 months, Tom had to go to the hospital for a hernia operation. The nurses made Tom's mom leave as he was suspended in a harness over his hospital bed. Tom remembers screaming and pleading for his mom not to go. She went anyway. Tom's interpretation about himself was that he's insignificant and not heard. Tom's interpretation about people is that they don't listen and that they leave and abandon you. Tom's survival formula is to be quiet. You're not heard anyway. At the age of 18 months, Tom stopped communicating. He had tried his best to be heard in a dire situation, but in spite of his yelling and his screaming, his mom didn't seem to hear him, and she left anyway. Tom grew up as the quietest boy in his class. He rarely asked for things like most children do. He had decided that it wouldn't make any difference. He wouldn't be heard. When Tom didn't receive those things that he wanted, and of course, no one knew what he wanted because he never asked, he decided that it was because no one loved him and that no one listened to him. Even then, Tom remained quiet, thinking that if he spoke up and requested things, people would become angry and leave him. Case study number 8. Here are the facts. At age 7, Bobby was playing with matches in his bedroom, and his model car caught fire. The flames from his model car spread to the curtains. Bobby panicked and vainly tried to put the fire out. By the time he ran to tell his parents, the fire had spread throughout the house. The house burned to the ground. Bobby's friend told him that his dad had called Bobby an evil brat. Bobby went to live with his grandmother for 3 months after that. Bobby's interpretation about himself was that he was evil and that he deserved bad things and to be punished. He's also a throwaway. Bobby's interpretation about people is that people suffer because of evil people like him. Bobby's survival formula became to be good. As he watched his house burn down, Bobby decided that he would deserve whatever bad things happened to him for the rest of his life. When his mom and his dad sent him to live with his grandmother, he reasoned that it was because he was bad and that they didn't love him or want him anymore. Bobby didn't comprehend that his parents' home was underinsured and that it took them 3 years before they could provide him with another suitable home. At the age of 18, Bobby entered the seminary and later became a priest. Bobby spent the rest of his life attempting to contribute to society by working among the poor. However, no matter how hard he tried to make amends, Bobby was unable to rid himself of the guilt that originated from his mistake at age 7. Case study number 9. Here are the facts. In first grade, Jane was afraid to ask the teacher for permission to go to the bathroom. She wet her pants. Her classmates laughed at her as a puddle formed underneath her desk. Her teacher made her stand in the corner as punishment for not speaking up and asking to go to the bathroom. Jane's interpretation about herself was that she was stupid. Her interpretation about other people is at their mean. Jane's survival formula was to play small, not risk, and try to remain invisible. Jane had been humiliated twice that day, first when she wet her pants, and then when she was made to stand in the corner. She decided that if she had been smart, she would have asked to go to the bathroom. She reasoned that she was humiliated because she was stupid and because everyone knew that she was stupid. She also decided that people make fun of stupid people. Her conclusion was, the best that stupid people like her can do is to try to make it through life without making a fool of themselves, as she had done in the past. Case study number 10. Here are the facts. At age 7, Tommy had 2 chocolate bars he got for Halloween while trick-or-treating. 1 bar had peanuts, when 1 was plain chocolate. Tommy didn't like peanuts, so he gave that candy bar to his 3-year-old brother Nick. A peanut lodged in Nick's trachea, and he began to turn blue. Tommy ran yelling for his mom, who was able to dislodge the peanut. Tommy's mom scolded him for being so stupid as to give a 3-year-old a candy bar with nuts. Tommy's interpretation about himself was that he was selfish and stupid, and that he was bad and that he hurt people. His interpretation about other people was that people are fragile and that they're easily damaged. Tommy's survival formula was to avoid anything risky and to play it safe. The day that Nick nearly choked to death was the day that Tommy's spirit died. He could not forgive himself. He should have eaten the candy bar with nuts and given his brother the one without. How could he have been so stupid and selfish? Tommy's communication shut down from that day forward. He rarely spoke in groups or to strangers. He withheld his opinion and rarely contributed to others for fear of hurting them. He became an introvert in school and avoided social activities. Wherever he went, Tom was known as the nice guy that no one heard a word from. Case study number 11. Here are the facts. At age 6, Mohammed moved from Pakistan with his parents to New York City. While walking home after his first day of school, 3 10-year-old kids called him a Muslim murderer, and they repeatedly punched him in the stomach. Mohammed ran home crying. Mohammed's 15-year-old brother said, "That's just like Americans. No wonder why we attacked them on September 11th. Mohammed's interpretation about himself was that he was different, he didn't belong, and he was hated. His interpretation about other people was that people are hateful, cruel, and unfair. They hurt you if you don't hurt them first. Mohammed's survival formula was to get others before they get you. Mohammed's mood of rage first manifested that day when he was beaten. He hated Americans and decided that they were hateful animals and vowed that he would make them pay someday. As he grew older, other incidents of racial hatred further reinforced Mohammed's conviction that Americans were evil, hateful people. Mohammed decided that he would get revenge on all Americans by becoming a terrorist martyr. Let's see how they like suffering for a change, he thought. Case study number 12. Here are the facts. When Brett was 7 years old, his dad died in the New York City World Trade Center attacks. Brett's mom cried herself to sleep almost every night for 6 months afterward. Brett's interpretation about himself was that he was weak and helpless. His interpretation about other people was that foreigners are evil and that they kill good people. His survival formula became to hate and to fear anyone different than you. Brett decided that people who are different are evil and that they can't be trusted. Brett looked for opportunities to hate those that he saw as different, especially those with different skin color and religious backgrounds. Brett became a bigot at age 7. He later joined a white supremacist gang and took part in vicious attacks on people of color. Case study number 13. Here are the facts. When Kathy was 3 years old, her parents divorced. Kathy went to live in an apartment with her mom. Kathy's interpretation about herself was that she was bad and unlovable and drove her dad away. Her interpretation about other people was that people leave, that they don't love her, and that her dad left because he didn't love her. Kathy's survival formula became to leave others before they leave you. At age 3, Kathy decided that people want to leave her because she's not good enough and not worthy of love. Kathy has experienced dozens of broken relationships and 4 failed marriages. At the first sign of problems, Kathy either makes life with her partner so miserable that he leaves, or she severs a relationship, proving that people leave and that she's unlovable. Case study number 14. Here are the facts. Anthony preferred playing with his friends rather than doing household chores. On several occasions, starting when he was age 7, Anthony's mom got angry and called him fat and lazy. Anthony's interpretation about himself was that he was fat and he also must be ugly too. He was lazy and he must be worthless too. His interpretation about other people is that people don't like him and that he doesn't belong. Anthony's survival formula was to hide out and to not let other people know his weaknesses. Anthony was a normal 7-year-old loving life and wanting to play all day long. His mom often became easily frustrated and took out her anger on her son. Growing up, Anthony seldom dated. He felt that no one would want to go out with such a useless, ugly, fat jerk like himself. He became a recluse, hiding out in the apartment and venturing out into the world only when it was absolutely necessary. He often heard people talk about him behind his back. He knew it was because he was a loser.
Thanks for listening. This concludes this part of the Self-Esteem book. Please continue with part 4.